I'm Gary Knoll, and this is the Progressive Commentary Hour. We have a special presentation, Understanding the Conflict in the Middle East, Making Sense of It. What we know is that there are many characters involved. We also know that the American media, either by intent or neglect, has not been honest with us, nor has our administration nor any official governmental agency. As a result, most of the media, including alternative media such as PBS and NPR, have been sharing or parroting the official public line, and that is that we are needed in the Middle East to bring peace and democracy and freedom to the citizens, for example, of Syria, and that 250,000 plus citizens have died there, all because of one man. And that one man, the president of Syria, is responsible. Therefore, we have a moral obligation to remove him, even though it's a sovereign nation, even though the majority of the people elected him and support him, that is irrelevant. And we are supporting, without military gear, but in other, let's say, humanitarian ways, with educating them about how to deal with Assad, the moderate Islamics in the area. And we made the public believe that this in no way is associated with supporting al-Nusra or ISIS or al-Qaeda. But we have found, with a detailed investigative report of more than 1 year of research, that virtually everything our administration has told us is either incomplete, disingenuous, or out-and-out lies. Our program, which will be in several parts, will take this entire question of what's actually happening in Syria as a puzzle. I will be sharing commentaries from multiple individuals, from Robert Perry, Can Obama Level with the People, from Consortium News, and Lost on the Dark Side in Syria, from Alistair Crook, from Consortium News. Five Truths You Should Know About Terrorism and Islam by Faisal Khoudi from Counterpunch. 10 years on, Iraq Lies in Ruins as New Evidence Confirms U.S. Government Used Death Squads to Manufacture Civil War by Joe Quinn of SoftNet. Those are just some of more than 20 reports I will offer, plus audio clips that will define the overview of what's happening in the Middle East. The Middle East will include a look at what is happening in Israel from the Palestinian and the Israeli perspective. And we're fortunate to be able to hear an in-depth discussion by a former officer in the army whose father was one of the founders of the current state of Israel back in 1947 and was a general. And he is also a person that believes deeply in the state of Israel. And so his insider information, I believe, will be particularly relevant. We will be also hearing about the proof the U.S. government wanted ISIS to emerge. Also, we will look at France arming jihadists in Syria since 2011, how to respond when someone blames all Muslims for ISIS, how the U.S. companies profit from war, truth in media, the origin of ISIS. Also, Hassan gives war on terror reality check. Noam Chomsky on the U.S. bombing of the hospital in Afghanistan. And a challenge to objectivity in Israeli reporting. And why do people become Islamic extremists? Again, these are audio clips that will be inserted. If with each of the commentaries that I share, I will take a break in the commentary and explain what it is that's being said, if it is too technical or if it might seem somewhat arcane. And we will begin in a few moments with our panelist, Professor Norman Pollack. Professor Norman Pollack is a professor emeritus of history at Michigan State University in East Lansing, Michigan. He has a long history of engaging in civil rights and anti-war activities for decades. beginning when he was 15 and campaigning with Henry Wallace and his Progressive Party in 1948. He later campaigned for Adlai Stevenson in the 50s in support of Martin Luther King. He's a two-time Guggenheim Fellow. He is a major intellectual voice during the 1960s in giving a great deal of boost to the New Left and writing on American populism, which became a popular documentary, The Populist Mind. After receiving his doctorate in American Civilization from Harvard University, he taught at Yale University and Wayne State before going to Michigan. In his latter years, he has focused on the history of civil disobedience, social political alienation, and the sociology of fascism. He currently writes for Counterpunch and investigates America's descent into a new form of neoliberal fascism. We will go to him after I begin by sharing some unusual insights. Our first insight comes from the London Review of Books, and I'll explain why each piece of this puzzle is important and how it makes sense. This is a review of Seymour Hersh on Obama and the president of Turkey and of the Syrian rebels. It is called The Red Line and the Rat Line. I'll quote it verbatim. In 2011, Barack Obama led an allied military intervention in Libya without consulting the U.S. Congress. Last August, after the sarin gas attack on the Damascus suburb of Ghouta, he was ready to launch an allied airstrike, this time to punish the Syrian government for allegedly crossing the red line he had set in 2012 on the use of chemical weapons. Then, with less than 2 days to go before the planned strike, he announced that he would seek congressional approval for the intervention. The strike was postponed as Congress prepared for hearings and subsequently canceled when Obama accepted Assad's offer to relinquish his chemical arsenal in a deal brokered by Russia. Why did Obama delay and then relent on Syria when he was not shy about rushing into Libya? The answer lies in a clash between those in the administration who were committed to enforcing that red line and the military leaders who thought that going to war was both unjustified and potentially disastrous. Obama's change of mind had its origins at Porton Don, the defense laboratory in Wiltshire. British intelligence had obtained a sample of the sarin gas used in the attack on August 21st, and analysis demonstrated that the gas used did not match the batches known to exist in the Syrian army's chemical weapons arsenal. The message that the case against Syria wouldn't hold up was quickly relayed to the U.S. Joint Chiefs of Staff. The British report heightened doubts inside the Pentagon. The Joint Chiefs were already preparing to warn Obama that his plans for a far-reaching bomb and missile attack on Syria's infrastructure could lead to a wider war in the Middle East. As a consequence of the American officers delivered a last-minute caution to the president, which in their view eventually led to his canceling the attack. Now, as an aside, remember, all over the media, including on Pacifica stations, including on NPR and all the major networks, but really beating the drums, was Fox and even MSNBC. And the idea was that how could we not go to war against Syria when the Syrian government and the president were killing their own citizens with gas? And it harkened back to when Saddam Hussein used chemical weapons, gas, on the Kurds and the Iranians. Now, little note was made about the Iranian deaths. After all, America supported the attack as well as Saudi Arabia and gave intelligence, weapons, and training to Saddam Hussein for the many years, the 8 years that battle was going on with over 1 million Iranian dead. And it was the Americans, and I discovered this in my own original investigative report that I published a major cover story article on, that showed that the United States government had secretly transferred the ingredients for combining into chemical weapons to Saddam Hussein. And we even found the invoices, we found the bills of lading, and the British also did the same. So when he was killing the Kurds and he was killing the Iranians, we let it go. Later, that's what he was hung for, because he had killed the civilians. And yet at no time in that trial could I find that the American government took any responsibility for providing him with the weapons of mass destruction and then covering all those years. So here we have now the President of the United States saying, we've got to do something, and then remember how it was sold to us. Think back for a moment. We are not going to attack the, you know, Syrian people, but instead we're going to take out some of his defenses. In other words, it was going to be a light tap, just to show him that he can't do this and get away with it. In effect, we were going to give him some very measured affliction, the affliction of war and blowing up some of his weapons depot. That is what we said. Now, listen carefully to what they were actually planning. This is new information for the vast majority of listeners, because you didn't know what was really being planned. The media never told us. Quote, for months there had been acute concern among senior military leaders and the intelligence community about the role in the war of Syria's neighbors, especially Turkey. The prime minister was known to be supporting the al-Nusra Front, a jihadist faction among the rebel opposition, as well as other Islamic rebel groups. Quote, we knew they were some in the Turkish government, a former senior U.S. intelligence official who has access to current intelligence told me, quote, who believe they could get Assad's nuts in a vice by dabbling with a sarin attack inside Syria and forcing Obama to make good on his red line threat. Now an aside. So here our government at the highest levels of military intelligence, the CIA, the National Defense Groups under the National Security Agency, all knew that our ally, Turkey, and the head of Turkey were actively supporting with munitions and training and financing al-Nusra, one of the most lethal, radical, jihadist groups in the world, right up there, shoulder to shoulder with ISIS and with al-Qaeda. No difference. So we were supporting an ally who was supporting terrorism. And Saudi Arabia was no better. Saudi Arabia had planned, trained, financed almost all of the Sunni radical jihadist groups for over 40 years. And we knew this. But because they dealt with tens of billions of dollars in weapons procurement from the United States manufacturers, and they gave us oil, they were the good allies supporting bad terrorists. What would happen if the President of the United States, any member of the Democratic or Republican side who were on intelligence committees, who would have known this, they would have been briefed, not a single member of Congress stood up and said, there is something wrong when the United States and its citizens from their tax dollars are supporting terrorism. And yet we're told that we're fighting terrorism. And we're told that we need to take away more of our rights and more of our constitutional protections in order to keep us safe, when they fully well knew they, the United States government, every member of the Congressional Oversight Committees and the Senate Oversight Intelligence Committees knew full well that we were allies with those who were completely behind, 100% supporting terrorism, as were we. So then we are then the major suppliers of weapons, financing, information, intelligence, and we were blaming Assad? We were putting it all on him? Well, we did that once before with Ho Chi Minh, and then we did it against Saddam Hussein, and we did it against Gaddafi. And the American public and the American media did not challenge it. So then back to the script. Quote, the Joint Chiefs also knew that Obama administration's public claim that only the Syrian army had access to sarin was wrong. The American and British intelligence communities have been aware since the spring of 2013 that some rebel units in Syria were developing chemical weapons. On June 20th, an analysis for the U.S. Defense Intelligence Agency issued a highly classified five-page talking points briefing for the DIA and its deputy director, David Shedd, which stated that al-Nusra maintained a sarin production cell. Its program, the paper said, was, quote, the most advanced sarin plot since al-Qaeda's pre-9/11 effort. Now, according to the Defense Department consultant, U.S. intelligence has long known that al-Qaeda experimented with chemical weapons and has a video of one of its gas experiments with dogs. The DIA, and remember, that's one of the highest groups of, that's the U.S. Defense Intelligence Agency, they're the ones who inform the president of everything going on in the entire intelligence community, they knew. And their paper went on, quote, previous intelligence community focus has been almost entirely on Syria's chemical weapons stockpile. Now we see ANF attempting to make its own chemical weapons. Al-Nusra Front relative freedom of operation within Syria leads us to assess the group's chemical weapons aspirations will be difficult to disrupt in the future, end quote. The paper drew on classified intelligence from numerous agencies. Quote, Turkey and Saudi Arabia chemical facilitators, it said, were attempting to obtain sarin precursors in bulk, 10 kilograms, likely for the anticipated large-scale production effort in Syria, end quote. So let's think about that for a moment. So all of our intelligence top people, the head of the CIA, national intelligence agencies, President of the United States, his cabinet, all knew, as did all the top members of Congress who were on intelligence committees, and that's a lot of people, they all knew that our allies, Saudi Arabia and Turkey, were creating and giving sarin poison gas components to al-Nusra in order to use, blame it on Assad, and then giving justification for the attack. So this goes beyond any breach of national sovereignty and breaking international laws. Back to the text. Quote, last May, more than 10 members of al-Nusra Front were arrested in southern Turkey with what local police told the press were 2 kilograms of sarin. In a 130-page indictment, the group was accused of attempting to purchase fuses, piping for the construction of mortars, and chemical precursors for sarin gas. 5 of those arrested were freed after a brief detention. The others, including the ringleader, a man named Hatem Quazab, for whom the prosecutor requested a prison sentence of 25 years, were released pending trial. Then they're gone. And this is in Turkey. In the meantime, the Turkish press has been rife with speculation that the Erdogan administration has been covering up the extent of its involvement with the rebels. In a news conference last summer, Turkey's ambassador to Moscow dismissed the arrest and claimed to reporters that the recovered sarin was merely antifreeze. He lied. The DIA paper took the arrest as evidence that al-Nusra was expanding its access to chemical weapons. It said Quaisov had, quote, self-identified as a member of al-Nusra and that he was directly connected to Ab al-Ghani, an ANF emir for military manufacturing. And he and associate worked with the Halit, an employee of a Turkish firm called Zerv Export, who provided price quotes for bulk quantities of sarin precursors, and that his plan was for 2 associates to, quote, perfect a process for making sarin gas and go to Syria to train others to begin large-scale production at an unidentified lab in Syria. End quote. Now, the DIA paper said that one of the operatives had purchased a precursor on the, quote, Baghdad chemical market, which was, quote, supported at least seven chemical weapons efforts since 2004. A series of chemical weapons attacks in March and April 2013 were investigated over the next few months by a special UN mission to Syria. A person with close knowledge of the UN's activity in Syria told me there was an evidence linking the Syrian opposition to the first gas attack on the 19th of March and Khan el-Assal, a village near Aleppo. In its final report in December, the mission said that at least 19 civilians, one Syrian soldier, were among the fatalities, along with scores of injured. It had no mandate to assign responsibility for the attack, but the person with knowledge of the UN's activity said, quote, investigators interviewed the people who were there, including the doctors who treated the victims. It was clear that the rebels, let me repeat this, it was clear that the rebels used the sarin gas. It did not come out in public because no one wanted to know, end quote. And in the months before the attacks began, a former senior Defense Department official told me the DIA was circulating a daily classified report known as SIRIP on all the intelligence related to the Syrian conflict, including material and chemical weapons. But in the spring, distribution of the part of the report concerning chemical weapons was severely curtailed on the orders of Dennis McDonoghue, the White House chief of staff. Quote, something was in there that triggered a fit by McDonald, the former Defense Department agent said, quote, one day it was a huge deal, and then after the March and April sarin attacks, he snapped his fingers, it's no longer there. The decision to restrict distribution was made to the Joint Chiefs ordered intensive contingency plans for a possible ground invasion. The former intelligence official said that many in the U.S. national security establishment had long been troubled by the president's red line. Quote, the Joint Chiefs asked the White House, what does red line mean? How does that translate into military orders? Troops on the ground, massive strike, limited strike? End quote. They tasked military intelligence to study how we could carry out the threat. They learned nothing more than the president's reasoning. In the aftermath of the August 21st attack, Obama ordered the Pentagon to draw up targets for the bombing. Early in the process, the former intelligence official said, quote, the White House rejected 35 target sets provided by the Joint Chiefs of Staff as being insufficiently painful to the Assad regime. The original targets included only military sites and nothing by way of civilian infrastructure. Now listen very carefully, because I believe that this constitutes crimes against humanity, war crimes, and this is very important. So the lawyers in this audience, the constitutionalists in this audience, listen carefully. Quote, under the White House pressure, the U.S. attack plan involved a, quote, monster strike. Two wings of B-52 bombers were shifted to air bases close to Syria, and Navy submarines and ships equipped with Tomahawk missiles were deployed. Every day the target list was getting longer, the former intelligence official told me. The Pentagon planners said, we can't use only Tomahawks and to strike at Syria's missile sites because their warheads are buried too far below ground, so the two B-52 wings with 2,000-pound bombs were assigned to the mission. Then we'll need standby search and rescue teams to recover downed pilots and drones for target selection. It became huge. The new target list was meant to completely eradicate any military capabilities as Assad had. The former intelligence agency said, quote, the core targets included electric power grids. Okay, stop for a moment. It is against international law to target electrical grids, water treatment facilities, civilian infrastructure, because then when you take out the power, you're taking out the process of being able to clean water, for example. And this is what the Clintons did in the Iraq campaign, and as a result, the infrastructure was substantially damaged. Then they wouldn't allow parts to be brought in to fix it, and hence 500,000 innocent Iraqi children died, mainly from infectious diseases, waterborne diseases, because the people did not have clean water to drink. Now, the military did, Saddam Hussein and his Ba'athist Guard did, but not his citizens. When Madeleine Albright was asked by Leslie Stahl in 60 Minutes, "Do you think it was worth it," meaning killing 500,000 children, "in order to put pressure on Saddam Hussein," she said, "Yes." And I'm sure many of you would ask, how does killing 500,000 children by engaging in illegal activity, knocking out civilian infrastructure, how does that constitute something that is in any way representing a proper way of dealing with civilians? So here Barack Obama was going to do the same. He and he alone was responsible for that decision, had this gone forward. So if you could imagine Gaddafi and Libya, imagine Iraq with the heavy bombing, you would have seen the same thing in Syria. But also al-Nusra, ISIS, al-Qaeda, and over 15 other radicalized Islamic jihadist groups would have taken over all Syria, and by this time, you would have had massive butchery. You had had beheadings into the tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, possibly millions, because that's their method. And they want to show the world. Then they would have an entire country, a country that no one could take back. And that would be a completely failed state, as we had today in Libya, and also look at Iraq. So this is an aside here. And there's something also important here. And the last thing I will read from this is the following. The UK defense staff who relayed the Porton Down findings to the Joint Chief of Staff were sending the Americans a message. The former intelligence official said, quote, "We're being set up here." And this account makes sense of the terse message a senior official in the CIA sent in late August. Quote, "It was not the result of the current regime," meaning Assad's Syrian regime. "UK and US know this," end quote. So just imagine the French, the British and Americans, and the Saudis would have engaged in this effort had it not been for a deal that was struck that allowed them to remove and destroy all their chemical weapons. But keep in mind, this is the kind of politicking by the neocons, those in special interest. And how many people who are influencing the president's decision and the National Security Agency's decisions are private military contractors who have the money and the lobbying and the inside by generals and admirals and procurement officers to get their point made. And then they follow it up by going on television, never once identifying their financial conflicts of interest and having foundations, the Heritage Foundation and others, pounding for war, and the average American thinking, well, it must be this way. Now, one other piece before we go to my guest who's standing by. This is from Jonathan Marshall from Consortium. And this is an important lesson for understanding what you're going to get if you don't get rid of ISIS and all of these radical groups, including the Free Syrian Army, which is filled with radicals and jihadists. There is no such thing as a moderate jihadist. You cannot find a contemplative or responsible executioner, a Sunni executioner, and they're all Sunnis, in this conflict, in these groups, though they have mercenaries from all over the world who are going for the money. This is entitled "How Gaddafi's Ouster Unleashed Terror." Quote, "The bloody terrorist attacks in Paris had their genesis not only in the poor Muslim suburbs of France and Belgium and on the battlefields of Syria, but also in NATO's operation to overthrow Gaddafi in 2011. The Libyan strongman gave the West fair warning at the time that his ouster would give an enormous boost to radical jihadists. Because no one in power listened, thousands have died in Libya, Syria, Iraq, Mali, and now France. Among the many extremist groups running wild in Libya today is the Islamic State, also known as ISIS, ISIL, and headquartered in the city in the center of Libya, the late Gaddafi's hometown on the central Mediterranean coast. The ISIS colony now hosts as many as 3,000 foreign fighters who enforce their own iron rule over a 150-mile stretch of the country's coast. ISIS also has a strong presence in northeastern Libya around the towns of Derna and Benghazi. Since Gaddafi's fall in 2011, Libya has exported thousands of its own terrorists to support jihad in other countries. In Syria, one group of Libyan supporters of ISIS went by the name of Bashar al-Labai. One of its leaders was none other than the suspected organizer of the recent Paris attacks. His connection to those Libyan fighters in Syria was first established back in January, before the killing in Paris by Belgian researcher, and on January 15th, Belgian police killed two members of the radical organization in the town of Verviers, where they were said to be planning a major terrorist attack. Quote, after the fold attacks in the town in Belgium, it became clear that the main suspect can be linked directly to this group. His little brother, age 14 and hence probably the youngest foreign fighter in Syria, has been portrayed multiple times in the ranks of Libyan fighters in Syria. End quote. Now, photos posted on the blog showed a grinning, bearded Belgian fighter posed for a portrait in Syria, as if on holiday. He recently observed that many Belgian jihadists were attracted to al-Badr because they immigrated from eastern Morocco, where they speak a dialect similar to that of in Libya. And last year, a Washington researcher called the group, quote, the Libyan division of the Islamic State of Iraq. He added, Libya itself has been a big source of mujahideen in both Iraq and Syria over the past decade. So the fact that there is a battalion devoted to recruiting Libyan fighters should come as no surprise. The existence of al-Badr as a front group for ISIS persists, perhaps reflects a wider pro-ISIS trend across Central Africa, end quote. A subsequent report by two members of the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace commented on the role of Libyan jihadists who returned home from Syria to commit atrocities on behalf of ISIS, including car bombings, attacks on hotels and embassies, and a brutal slaughter of Egyptian cops. The analysts trace much of the violence to veterans of this group who were active in Benghazi and Derna. Quote, Libyans had already begun traveling to fight in Syria in 2011, joining existing jihadi factions or starting their own. In 2012, one group of Libyans in Syria declared the establishment of the Badr Brigade in a statement laden with anti-Shia sectarianism. The Badr Brigade founders also thanked the citizens of Derna, a city in northeastern Libya, long known as a hotbed of radical Islamicism, for their support for the struggle of Syria. And then it goes on to talk about 800 veterans of this brigade in just one town in Libya, Derna. And they proceeded to execute local judges, journalists, army officers, and anyone else deemed un-Islamic. They sent suicide bombers to Tobruk, the temporary headquarters of Libya's national parliament, to Benghazi, and to the embassies of Egypt and the United Arab Emirates in Tripoli. And mind you, why do I share this with you? Because back in March of 2011, while battling foes of his regime, Colonel Gaddafi warned that such mayhem could follow his defeat. He told a French newspaper, quote, I'm surprised that nobody understands that this is a fight against terrorism. If his opponents prevailed, Gaddafi predicted, quote, there will be an Islamic jihad in front of you in the Mediterranean. He was right. Hillary Clinton, Obama, NATO, France, England were all wrong. In fact, French President Nicolas Sarkozy chose to ignore such warnings, and both British Prime Minister David Cameron dragged a reluctant President Obama into supporting NATO strikes against Gaddafi in the name of humanitarian motives. Sound familiar? Iraq, humanitarian motives. It just keeps going on. You would think that the average American would understand how they've been lied to. But in blatant violation of the United Nations Security Council mandate approving the use of force only to protect civilians, Sarkozy, Cameron, and Obama admitted to an op-ed editorial on April 14, 2011, that their real agenda was to oust Gaddafi, quote, for good, so that, quote, a new generation of leaders can take over. That is illegal by every standard of international law. You do not have the right, because you do not like a sovereign head of government, to kill him, assassinate him, to have his own citizens through your coercion and manipulation and provocateurs to do the same. NATO leaders were triumphant after opponents murdered Gaddafi on October 20, 2011. In the infamous words of then Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, echoing Julius Caesar, quote, we came, we saw, he died. With the release of Hillary Clinton's emails, we now know that she had learned from an advisor that France was stoking the uprising to impose, quote, a new government of Libya to favor French firms and national interests, particularly regarding the oil industry in Libya, end quote. France used humanitarian flights to shuttle executives from leading oil and construction and aerospace firms into Libya to negotiate with the opposition so they could profit from the new order. To this day, Clinton remains unapologetic about her strong advocacy of U.S. intervention. Yet Libya has become the lawless land fought over by 1,700 armed groups and militias. At least a third of the country's population has been affected by the fighting and lacks adequate access to health service, food. Libya today, in spite of the expectations that Americans and others had, are much worse, said one Middle Eastern expert on PBS's Frontline. Quote, criminality is skyrocketing, insecurity is pervasive, there are no jobs, it's hard to get food and electricity, there's fighting, there's fear, I see very few bright spots. Now, outside of Libya, the results of Western intervention was to spread jihadism and deadly weapons all over North Africa, the Middle East. Al-Qaeda, North Africa affiliate, obtained vast stores of rocket-propelled anti-tank grenades, heavy machine guns, explosives, and even shoulder-fired surface-to-air missiles from Gaddafi's armories. Bruce Hoffman, director of the Center for Security Studies at Georgetown University, said Islamic militias in the region became, quote, armed almost to the extent of a small army after the collapse of Libya, end quote. In Mali, an affiliate of Al-Qaeda used their new firepower to occupy the north half of the country, impose strict Sharia law, and seize and destroy much of the historic city of Timbuktu. In November, Al-Qaeda fighters stormed the luxury hotel in Mali's capital, killing more than two dozen captives before French and Malian troops dislodged the terrorist. Elsewhere in North Africa, reported John Lee Anderson, quote, gunmen who trained with ISIS in Libya were involved in the murder of 20 foreign tourists at a Tunis museum in March, and 38 more tourists, most of them British, at a seaside resort in Tunisia in June, end quote. And then there is Syria, where Libyans flock to hone their fighting skills. In 2012, the Defense Intelligence Agency, which predicted the rise of ISIS in Syria, noted that after Gaddafi's downfall, jihadists shipped weapons from former Libyan military stockpiles to Syria to arm Salafist rebels. So in conclusion, one of the main jobs of the CIA station in Benghazi before the devastating September 11, 2000 attack on the U.S. mission was to track those armed shipments. The group behind the attack was blacklisted by the United Nations in 2014 for, quote, links to Al-Qaeda and for running camps for Islamic State groups. First Iraq, then Libya, now Syria. Western leaders, along with their allies in the Arab states and Israel, have created multiple monsters that will threaten our societies for years to come. And yet, we in the United States continue to believe and trust in politicians and members of special interest groups and front groups, neocons and fascists, that what we're doing is not enough and we need to do more. More to come, but now let's go to my guest standing by, Professor Norman Pollack. I gave you his background at the beginning of the program. Nice to have you with us today, Professor Pollack.
Thanks very much, Gary. I was so struck by your summary. It was very good. And I don't know what I can add. I can sort of jump around a little bit. And some of the things that I've tried to develop are just a little bit outside of what you were saying. So let me just throw out a few things. I had an article recently called Syria Civil War? No, a proxy war of global confrontation. And we, as you said at the beginning, that so much is repeated about sarin gas and so on, and Assad being responsible, which has, I think, been, the evidence shows, is thoroughly repudiated now, even though we hold to it, and even though we're still laboring on, from everything you've said, we're still laboring under a conspiracy of silence and the suppression of evidence. So it's going to be very hard to get these things straightened out. So one of the points that I kept asking for quite a while, because Syria really has been in the crosshairs for several years, is why this hatred of Assad and what is behind it, especially when the evidence used to justify it is fraudulent, is manufactured, and so on. So what I found myself doing in this article, first, just thinking about it, I was reminded about parallels with the Spanish Civil War of the late 1930s, in that in both cases we see a dress rehearsal for building a wider conflict. And I think that so much of the antagonism toward Syria and toward Assad is that, among other things, he has been supported by both Russia and Iran, both of which are completely non-acceptable to the West and to Israel, and to the Saudis, and to Turkey, feelings which have come out more and more prominently over the last few weeks, and especially with the downing of the jet just a few days ago. And what I think one really sees here is that the international context for the analysis of Syria is sort of determining. It's determining in that it seems to me, and I think I'm less forgiving, or whatever the word might be, less generous than, and you certainly were correctly critical, but I feel I'm even more critical of Obama, in that nothing must be permitted to achieve any kind of rapprochement between the West and Russia. And I think that when the plane was shot down, that what one sees here is that Erdogan just did not have that kind of freedom of action, that there had to have been a contingency plan that would make possible the further development of confrontation. The fact that Turkey to this moment has not admitted wrong, even though the plane that was shot down, I think, went over, if it did go over Turkish territory, it was for only 17 seconds, and this was all kind of absurd. But in that larger sense, what one sees here is that it isn't simply a kind of Sunni-Shia division where Saudi Arabia is going against Iran and this and that, a kind of very muddled kind of Near Eastern configuration of forces, but rather that it is really that kind of dress rehearsal for a new Cold War. And that if one gets in a little closer on Syria, I think one of the things that angers so much of the Middle Eastern powers is Syria's secularism. And you've got a region that is saturated in religiosity and so on, and however different the belief systems might be, there is really quite a bit of coordination between Israel and the Saudis, and that kind of cooperation is partly based on the fear that, I think, that secularism itself carries with it the possibility of democratization. And that when you have religion, no matter how different, and then my other article just a day or two ago with Israel and ISIS, no matter how different, even in that case, the belief systems are, there is still that sense in which religion provides for social control and provides for that clear maintenance of the status quo. And here is Assad, who is really, among other things, just not fitting in. He's not going along. He's not approving of the West's own larger position, certainly not in terms of international politics. And it seems that, to me, that Obama is using Syria as a kind of, let's just simply call it a kind of convenient hotspot in order to exacerbate international tension. And with Syria in that position, we see NATO forces moved up to the Russian border. We see Syria itself as becoming analogous to what is happening in the South China Sea. And there you see large American presence, and you see the preliminaries to a confrontation with China. And I think that the ambitions of the Obama administration, and with his new Defense Department secretary and the people he has at the UN and his National Security Advisor, you've got obviously a very hawkish bunch, but you've got a bunch that has this geopolitical vision of unilateral American global dominance. And that means really a kind of unremitting pressure applied at all points wherever that might lead to the kind of isolation and containment of those regarded as adversaries. So I think I'm going to say something really wild here, that Syria is almost irrelevant. It's almost irrelevant in the sense of the way Jean-Paul Sartre said that if there weren't Jews, the anti-Semites would have to invent Jews. If there weren't Syria, we would have had to invent it, and invent it in the sense that whether it's Syria or some other place, the important point is to really bear down. And I don't think you used the phrase, but it's certainly what you were talking about with the sarin gas. You have these false flag operations where, in this case, it seems like the evidence that you were bringing out, and maybe a little bit more, places a lot of this squarely on the shoulders of Erdogan and Turkey. And the precursors to the sarin coming in from Jordan, coming in from Turkey, and so on, and the assemblage right in Syria. Sure, it really points to that kind of operation and points to the absolute fraudulence of the U.S. claims of Assad's poisoning his own people, and therefore this kind of magical, what do we call this? Let's call it liberal humanitarianism or something that Samantha Power has popularized for us. But that becomes the justification that the United States, in pressing for clear hegemonic goals, will will cosmetize it, paper it over with the idea of humanitarianism. And what we do know, I think, is fair to say that even Assad at his proclaimed worst by the West, that in fact the U.S. and the West has amply supported many dictators over the years who've been guilty of human rights violations, and that just doesn't wash. One would almost think that if one were guilty, that would raise the individual in the individual leader in the estimation of the United States government. Hey, he's really like we are, or something to that effect. So everything that I think has been claimed has been spurious. I think the facts are now beginning to come out more and more. And let me say this, Gary, if I may, that it's that one cannot compartmentalize either personality structure. We saw this from the authoritarian personality studies back in 1951 that was so important, nor in public policy, so that when a government or regime, if you will, is guilty of particular practices, let's say in our case, and this is not hypothetical, let's say in our case, drone assassination or torture and waterboarding, then it is very doubtful that that same government can be the source of humanitarianism and human rights of any kind. So when you were saying about the bombing of the electricity grids and the water treatment plants, the thing that came to mind right away is that was precisely what Israel did with respect to Gaza. And that meant, if one goes back to that material, that people were dying even in the operating rooms when the electricity went out. And to make matters worse, people were on the hillside in I can't remember the town now, in Israel, overlooking Gaza and cheering the explosions. This was something that really got to me very much. And it's that same kind of punitiveness and cynicism, amorality, if you wish, or if you wish to go further, nihilism, that I think is characterizing U.S. policy. And now it is Syria, as you point out, that is bearing the brunt of this. And my sense is that in all of this, that ISIS, and I don't know, I think you were verging on saying this, but that ISIS also is something to be invented in this one sense, that its existence, and I think that the U.S. has been really more than half-hearted in trying to eradicate it compared with what Russia is now doing. And remember, Russia really is strongly opposed to terrorism. It's faced it with its own Chechen terrorists and so on. And I think Russia is really carrying the water in a lot of this.
Let me just interject here because we're coming up to the end of part one.
Sure,
we're going to
take
a station break. Some of the stations around the country will only be able to hear today part one, but on the Progressive Radio Network, they'll be able to hear all of these, all done in succession right now. But when we come back, we're going to talk about who really created ISIS, and we're going to give you three different perspectives and three different highly respected journalists. We're also going to look at Follow the Money Trail. Isn't it interesting that Russia, just in the last week, destroyed a large convoy of trucks, all oil trucks, that were taking that oil from Syria into Turkey, and then the Turks were then selling it, and this means that they were stealing oil, tens of billions of dollars worth of oil, from Syria. It also means that the ISIS was getting about $10 million a week in cash, and yet in this entire time, name me once where America bombed ISIS oil trucks. Also, it took the Russians to do it. And why didn't the United States, since it's so capable of following money trails, why didn't it stop all the financial transactions out of Saudi Arabia and Turkey that were financing any of these groups? It could have done so. it could have stopped the flow of cash of ISIS. Chose not to. We'll discuss why. I'm Gary Knoll. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour. This is the end of part one. We have multiple parts to come. For those of you who are only able to listen to one part today, you'll be able to download these on our archives, or we will continue to play these one per week per station around the United States as part of a special in-depth investigative report on the problems in the Middle East. My guest that you've just been listening to is Professor Norman Pollack, Professor Emeritus of History at Michigan State University. He has a long history of engaging in civil rights and anti-war activities for over almost six decades. And he actually was back clear back in the campaign for Henry Wallace and his Progressive Party in 1948. And he is a graduate of Harvard, a professor at Yale, Wayne State, Michigan State University. And I'm asking him to stay on for part two coming up. Thank you for listening. Back in a moment.